the beginning of 1944, number 115 Squadron of the Royal Air Force was cooperating with others in locating and bombing special targets in Hitler's Berlin. On the eve of March the 26th, Lancaster bomber DS-664, nicknamed Werewolf by its crew of seven, took off from Wychford near Ely and flew into the fury of the German night skies. The navigator, Sergeant Ginger Cleary, remembers that takeoff 25 years ago.
We took off while it was still daylight, flew towards the Norfolk coast and then out across the sea, and for the first time we saw some of the full strength of Bomber Command. The pilot said, "Come and look what's going on around us." On every side we could see streams of bombers making towards the German coast as dusk began to set in. I must say it was a remarkable sight to see the whole sky filled with four-engine bombers all converging for one point, which was somewhere in the Bay of Heligoland. We did see some desultory anti-aircraft fire, and I think as we were passing close to Sylt, one aircraft was brought down. Of course, by the time we reached the enemy coast, it was darkness, but the sky was quite brilliant with displays of AK-AK gunfire of all colours and of all kinds. We crossed north of Kiel, and we saw the full extent of the defences of Kiel by way of searchlights and AK-AK. I've never seen such concentrations of searchlights as we saw on the outside of Kiel on that particular night. And to my recollection, it was far more intense than anything we had seen in the Ruhr. We didn't alter course to avoid any of this. We simply took our chance in view of the fact that we were in the middle of a bomber stream and therefore there was safety in numbers. After Kiel, things quietened down a bit, and we flew across the Baltic, parallel with the North German coast, past Rostock, to a point north of Berlin. There we turned south on the bombing run towards the target.
All power clear now. We're coming in for a bombing run.
Left a bit. Steady. Left a touch. Steady. Left a bit. Steady. Left a touch. Steady. Bombs away.
The wireless operator, Sergeant Geoffrey Burwell, describes the bombing.
The old Lancaster lifted. I suppose it was glad to be relieved of the bombs. There was, I think it was a £4,000 cookie, so-called, and cans of phosphorus bombs. The bomb exploded on the ground in a pretty vivid sort of explosion, pretty colourful, and we turned on course for home.
Cleary remembers the false Met report they were given.
The Met situation before the flight, as discussed at the briefing situation, was not altogether satisfactory, and there was a strong possibility of fairly strong winds from the north to be encountered during the flight.
This is endorsed by the flight leader, Squadron Leader George Mackey.
Listening to Cleary talking about the winds that night brings this trip back to me quite clearly. I was flying myself, and I remember we took off, we climbed over the sea, and we went in over Denmark and along the Baltic coast and turned in to Berlin from the north. Now, I was an observer captain of aircraft, which was a peculiarity associated with 115 Squadron, and as such, we had a navigator. I did the bomb aiming and was captain of the aircraft, and I was able to spend a lot of time map reading, and at that time I was fairly familiar with Germany, being on my third tour, with the result that I knew the winds were wrong, and I was giving the navigator pinpoints, and we were in fact on track, and we were into Berlin early, and out early. On the way home, I again was picking up pinpoints, mainly from the positions of the searchlight groups. For example, I remember clearly that Hanover was an egg-shaped group, and I again was pinpointing our position, passing these to the navigator, who was setting courses that took us back, north of the Ruhr and out over the Dutch coast, on track. whereas we could see the main force going through the middle of the Ruhr and catching a great deal of AK-AK and obviously fighter activity. I also remember that when we got home, I was naturally somewhat incensed that the Pathfinder force had been passing false winds to the main force and sending them through the Ruhr, and we complained bitterly to group navigation and command. They took our log, the navigator's log, they backplotted it and found that we really were on track. And I also remember that the command navigation officer's answer was that Mackie should have stuck to the winds sent out, flown through the middle of the Ruhr, instead of using his common sense and his experience to be on track and stay out of trouble. It really was an exceptional night. Very seldom did the Pathfinder force send back bad winds, but in this case they were entirely out, and I think this was the cause of the main force running into a great deal of trouble that night.
The trouble encountered by Werewolf was a Ju-88 fighter.
Some heavy crack coming up astern. It's well below us, though. My God, did you see that one?
God, look at that one. Someone's brought in.
Can you see anything up there? Aircraft's on fire at the tail end. It's on fire at the front end as well. Sorry, lads, I can't hold her any longer. You'll have to bail out.
Nicholas Alcomard, Werewolf's rear gunner, takes up the story.
Before bailing out of the aircraft, I first of all had to obtain my parachute canopy, which was stowed inside the fuselage of the plane, primarily because of the bulky flying equipment I was wearing and the small confinement of the turret itself. I opened the turret doors and then the fuselage doors to climb back through the fuselage rear entrance to obtain my parachute. I was met by a blast of flames which looked like the inside of a giant blow lamp. I was beaten back by the flames and closed the inner doors to keep away from the flames and had to pause whilst I thought what to do. I realised that if I stayed where I was, I'd burn to death, so I determined to make one further effort to get my parachute. I opened the doors again, but by this time the fire had gained such a hold in the fuselage that the parachute itself was on fire. The outer casing had burned away, and the silk, which had packed under pressure, was just bouncing out and vanishing in puffs of flame. I realised at once then that the parachute wasn't going to be of any use to me, and I retreated again to the turret, which by then was in flames itself. My flying clothes were burning, my oxygen mask was melting on my face, and the heat was terrific. I had to do something, and I realised that I couldn't stay where I was, that I was going to die either in the fire, or as an alternative, I could die a quick, clean end on the ground. I made up my mind then that I would jump without the parachute to make a quick, clean finish. I rotated the turret by hand, opened the doors once more, and, rather in despair, threw myself out backwards. As I fell, I could see the stars above my boots, and I realised that I was falling rigidly to attention. The sense of peace and quiet and coolness was overpowering. I fell for a moment or two, and then I sensed the explosion of the aircraft as it flew away from me, and very shortly after that I blacked out. But even before I blacked out, I thought, well, if this is dying, there's just nothing to be afraid of. There was no fear, just an overwhelming calmness I had the thought that if this is dying, there's nothing strange to it at all. I regretted the fact that I was going to miss my leave, which was due to start the following Sunday, but my mind was rather occupied with such trivialities that the portent of death just didn't seem to exist. I blacked out, possibly due to shock, lack of oxygen, or a combination of both, and didn't know anything more until some 3 or 4 hours later I woke and found that I was lying on my back, and through a ragged hole in the treetops I could see the stars shining. I realised immediately that I was alive, marvelled at it, and said, "Jesus Christ, I'm alive." I couldn't understand how it was that I was alive, but I did realise that in fact I was. And I looked around me and found that I was lying in a snowdrift among some fir trees. I realised too that the fir trees must have broken the impetus of my fall, and then the snowdrift underneath the trees had further cushioned me. I checked all over my body to see if I was still intact and found that all my limbs would move. I felt very sore about the face and the back and the legs. And it wasn't until eventually when I arrived in hospital I found that the extent of my injuries were bruises, burns, lacerations, scalp wounds, and 3 or 4 shrapnel wounds. I tried to stand up, but my legs folded under me, and I couldn't walk. It was freezing cold, and I thought if I stayed there I would probably freeze to death. But as I couldn't walk, I lay and blew on the AC rescue whistle that we used to carry attached to our battle dress blouses. Blowing that and smoking cigarettes alternately, eventually I heard a German search party coming through the woods. Quickly they relieved me of my cigarettes, then hoisting me to my feet said, "March." I fell prostrate at their feet. So they placed me on a ground sheet or tarpaulin and dragged me over the fields away from the fringe of the wood where I'd landed. I think I hit every bump in the field. They took me to a little cottage in the village of Oberkirchen, where the old lady of the house regaled me on eggnog, which was the finest drink I'd ever had in my life.
Ginger Cleary recalls his experience when the plane caught fire.
I got up, went forward, looked through the curtains in between the cabin and the cockpit, saw that the starboard wing was badly ablaze with a long trail of flame issuing from the starboard wing. The aircraft then went into a steep, sloping dive. Almost instantaneously, I saw a dull orange-red thud of an explosion. I knew no more then until the next thing I realised I was out in space and falling fairly quickly. I don't remember putting on my parachute before I left the aircraft. I don't even remember opening the parachute. But when I looked up, the parachute was open above my head. The next thing I know was the ground rushing up very, very quickly towards me, and I remember crashing through some fairly large trees. From then on I can remember no more, and my next recollection is myself lying in the snow in this wood or forest among some fairly large trees. It was fairly light about this time, and I heard some voices in the distance coming towards me. I made some attempt to get out of the way until I could see who was approaching, but almost at that time I stumbled and fell, and next thing I realised I was being picked up by some of this German search party who had apparently come out looking for me. I was intensely cold, but apart from that, no great recollection. They picked me up and placed me on a sheet of tarpaulin, and then we made a slow descent down a rather steep slope, and in between times I kept losing consciousness.
The third survivor, Jeff Burwell, was blown out of Werewolf by the force of gravity.
I put my parachute on. I went to jump through the rear bulkhead door to get to the rear exit. And it was one mass of orange flame, hot, intense. You could feel it suddenly singe your face. So I slammed the door shut. I remember the bulkhead door, and I actually secured the catch. I tried to make my way forward to see if there was some means of getting out the front way. But there was a most terrific explosion. I found myself, first of all, upside down with my back on the roof. And whether it split open at that point or whether the aircraft blew up at that point, I disappeared into the night air. It was cold. I was unconscious, completely oblivious to all around me, probably due to the lack of oxygen at this height, but as I dropped, I was falling pretty fantastic speed. The descent ripped off my flying boots, my stockings, my watch. I lost my watch. And I came to, and I couldn't find my parachute. That's when I really panicked. Knew I'd clipped it on, and I looked above me, and I saw that the parachute was trailing on the end of about 10 feet of harness above me. I must have been falling in a properly downward position, because I pulled the parachute harness down, found the parachute handle, pulled it, and the parachute opened straight away, plop. I should think with no more than 5 or 6 seconds to spare. I was coming down backwards, and I could tell that by the stars. But before I could do anything, before the parachute even had a chance to break the impetus of the speed of the descent, I landed in the top of a fir tree. I was in the top of a tree. I began to swing until I managed to get my hands round the trunk of the tree. I disconnected the harness by pressing the instant release and started to climb down the tree. The ground, the snow on the ground, appeared about 10 feet below me, so I started to jump, and I jumped into what I thought was 2 or 3 inches of snow. In fact, I landed in about 5 feet of snow. Although we lost Werewolf, I know we got the enemy aircraft as well, because I was taken to a military prison, Whirl, and whilst I was in this military prison, I was visited by a young fighter pilot who came in, and whilst he didn't speak much English, I didn't speak any German, and from the conversation we managed to have, he told me that, in fact, he had been shot down, or he'd had to force land due to the rear gunner's fine shooting, and in fact, he was quite an average sort of person. He told me that this was war, and it was them or us. He didn't hold anything against me, and I think I was too young, really, to hold anything against him.
Alcamard and Cleary were taken to the same hospital.
I was taken to the operating theatre, and my wounds were cleaned, and I was bandaged up and installed in a comfortable bed, where I thought I would probably get a good night's sleep. But this wasn't to be, because shortly after I'd been put into the ward, two orderlies came and made it plain to me that another of my crew members was in the hospital and was in a very bad way, and would I join him. I was taken back down to the operating theatre, where in an annex was Sergeant Cleary, who was the navigator of my plane. He was unconscious, and the doctor told me that he'd suffered severe internal injuries and some frostbite, and his chances were very grim. He asked whether I would be good enough to sit with him until he recovered, if he would recover. That they'd given him the last rites, and should he regain consciousness, he might want to give me his last wishes. I sat with him for a long while. He eventually did regain consciousness, but was not lucid at all. But the doctor said that he had strengthened considerably, and that his chances of survival then would be very much better.
The next time I came round, I was in a hospital, in a bed, and sat by my bedside was a nurse and 2 Germans who later told me they were Air Force officers. I had been moved into a side ward, As I was told later on, the hospital to which I had been taken was in fact a maternity hospital, and the actual ward where I lay was the actual labour ward, and they had rather put me into this quiet little ward because they thought I was going to die, and rather than disturb the rest of the patients, they thought I would be better in this side ward. Sometime later on, Alkermaid was wheeled in and had a word with me, and then the sisters, through an interpreter, said that I would shortly be moved back with Alkermaid into another ward. And this happened in a matter of a day or so after that. I stayed in this ward with Alkermaid for some days. It may have been some weeks. I have no clear recollection of the time because I was particularly ill about this period. It was about this time that I realised the extent of my injuries. Not the worst trouble was frostbite, but what seemed to be of more immediate concern to the German medical staff was the fact that I had some difficulty in breathing. And they told me that I would have died but for the fact they managed to get back from a weekend leave a German surgeon who had done a slight operation on my neck to ease my breathing. Without this, they said, I would surely have died. My general condition improved to some extent, and I did converse with Alkermaid for quite some time. We did exchange words on various topics, although we were rather careful not to mention a good deal about the crash in case we thought the Germans may be listening and picking up any information. It was rather a shock some time later to find that Alkermaid had been told that he was fit enough to leave hospital and he would be taken down to Frankfurt. After that, I was left in the hospital on my own, except for the occasional company of another prisoner who would be either French or Italian. I was visited two or three times a week by a French prisoner of war who was a barber who gave me excellent shaves, and life wasn't too bad. The Germans had found out that I was a Catholic, and I received regular visits from a German priest. And the hospital, incidentally, was run by Roman Catholic nuns of a nursing order, and they were really kind themselves. I can express in point of fact, I must express my gratitude to the excellent way in which I was nursed by these Germans. They certainly bore nothing against me for being on the opposite side, and I was given treatment which undoubtedly saved my life under those circumstances.
At the prison camp, the German commandant did not at first believe that Alkermaid had jumped without a parachute.
During the interrogation, I'd remarked that I'd come down without a parachute. The officer who was interrogating me himself had been a flying type and was rather intrigued with this and asked me to elaborate on the story, which I did. So he said, well, have you any proof of this? So I said, well, I haven't, but you have. So he said, what do you mean by that? So I said, well, my parachute harness, which I'd been wearing when I came down, would still be intact. The lift webs would still be tied down onto the shoulder pieces. And the clips would, the hooks would be in the retaining clips on the chest piece. So he said, well, he'd look into this. And away he went. The next morning I was taken into the commandant's office and again was asked to tell my story direct to the commandant. This I did. And he said, well, we have your harness here, we'll just check it. So one of the orderlies brought in my parachute harness and put it on the desk for the examination. It was found to be, as I'd said, the lift webs were still down on the shoulder straps and the hooks were still in the retaining clips. So he said, well, it's obvious that the harness hasn't been used. Have you any other proof? So I said, well, you would find in the wreckage of the plane, in the rear stowage, what remained of my parachute canopy, the lift bar, the ripped cord, and the D-handle. Well, this would be investigated too. So I was returned to my cell with a fair supply of cigarettes and chocolates and so forth to wait further results. A couple of days later, I was again taken to the commandant's office, and there on his desk were the various charred pieces of metal, the lift bar, which was the main support piece for the canopy itself, the wire, ripcord, and the D-handle. He complimented me on my escape and said to his aides, "There, gentlemen, is a miracle." And then saying to me, "This is a story that you must tell your grandchildren."
A fellow POW who added his signature to the certificate was Ray Lamb, now a sub-postmaster in Surrey.
It was at Juletluft that I first met Alkemard. We were just idly chatting when several Germans burst excitedly into the compound. They were very excited in a pleased sort of way. This, in this place, was by itself most unusual. They very happily announced to Alkemard that they had found his parachute harness, and that it had not been opened, and it was therefore obviously true that he had not used his parachute. It then followed that his story of jumping out of his rear turret without a parachute was genuine. Alkemard asked if they were willing to sign a piece of paper to this effect, and they were very pleased so to do. Flight Lieutenant Moore, another flight sergeant, and myself were asked to witness these signatures, and it was our pleasure to be associated in such an insignificant way with such a very noteworthy, apparently impossible, but nevertheless true happening.
Wing Commander Peter Howard at the RAF Institute of Aviation Medicine gives the physiological aspects of Alkemard's 3.5 miles fall through space.
When a man falls or jumps from an aeroplane, he gathers speed, but only for something between 5 and 10 seconds until he's travelling downwards at about 120 miles an hour. Now, when he reaches the ground, what happens depends largely on the character of the terrain in which he falls, and the stopping distance is the important thing in determining whether or not there'll be damage. Clearly, he'll be hurt much more if he falls on concrete than if he falls into water. You can work it out that travelling from 120 miles an hour to rest over a distance of, let us say, 1 foot involves an average deceleration of about 400 to 500 times that of gravity, and this would undoubtedly be very injurious to anybody who experienced it. If by some means you can extend the distance of the deceleration to 10 feet, then the force involved is also reduced by a factor of 10, and provided that the attitude of the body were correct, this is a force which could be withstood. Mr. Alkemard first hit the branches of some fir trees, which would have absorbed a great deal of energy in bending and in breaking, and so when he struck the ground, his velocity was already substantially reduced. Then he fell into some snow, and the softness of the snow allowed him to complete his deceleration over a reasonably long distance. The total distance involved may well have been more than the 10 feet which I mentioned. Nevertheless, he was extremely fortunate in his choice of a landing place.
Today, Ginger Cleary is a technical inspector at the Ministry of Agriculture. Geoffrey Burwell is a police officer in Bournemouth, and Nicholas Alkemard, who lives near Leicester, is a sales representative in the furniture industry.
"There, gentlemen, is a miracle." And then saying to me, "This is a story that you must tell your grandchildren." Well, of course, now I'm in a position to do so. I am a grandfather. I have a little grandson, almost a year old, and I shall be telling him as soon as he can understand.